and Norm Shealy. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Hi, this is Eva Herr. Thanks so much for taking time out of your schedule to be with us this week. Tonight I have with us a guest talking about very special cutting-edge information. It's Dr. Michael Stone. He's from Asheville, North Carolina, and he knows this topic about as good as anybody I've seen out there today. So thank you, Dr. Stone, for taking time to be with us. I appreciate it. And if you don't mind, take a few minutes to tell us about yourself, what you do, where you do it, and how people can find you.
Sure. Well, my name is Michael Stone, Peter Michael Stone, and I actually practice in Ashland, Oregon, way out west.
Oh, sorry, got that wrong.
That's okay.
Here.
Southern end of the state of Oregon, and practice in this pretty progressive clinic with the immediate past president of Institute for Functional Medicine, and also David Jones, and also with my best friend and spouse, Dr. Leslie Stone. And we have a couple nurse practitioners and a PA and a couple nutritionists. And we try to get to the root cause of issues, everything from problems or challenges from preconception through pregnancy and then all the way up to the elder years. And so we look through the lens of functional medicine. And by doing that, you look at looking at the specifics now with the new technology of people's genome and people's genetics, and then how we wash things over those genes and turn those genes on and off with how we live to try to produce health and limit disease. And so that's what we do, and we've been both, Leslie and I have been practicing for over 30 years, and we have a very dynamic, a kind of cutting-edge perspective on how we can improve health and try to shift things over in the individual uniqueness of the patient.
I apologize for that. That's what happens when you have ADHD and you only look at one part of somebody's stuff. I'd see the ash, you know.
Sorry. No, that's fine. That's fine.
So let's start with, I've been doing series on genetics and methylation for the past 3 years.
Yes.
So my listeners are familiar with the topic, but as you know, most people only talk about this thing MTHFR and folic acid and B12.
Yeah.
There's so much more to it than that, and I'm going to kind of give you free rein to let you talk about where you think people should start figuring
sure.
out what their specific needs are, and once they figure out what you know, what's wrong with them, how to address those things. So please, the stage is yours.
Sure. Well, thank you for the opportunity and look forward to sharing information. You know, this is a wide open and exciting changing field. I think from some aspects, medicine and healthcare in the human genome era, we've realized that the earth is no longer flat. And so
I would like to say one thing to protect us both. Even though Dr. Stone is a medical doctor, he's not attempting to treat or diagnose you. What we're talking about on tonight's show is for informational purposes only. So if you learn something here tonight, please take it to your personal doctor.
Absolutely. That's true no matter where. We've lectured in 4 different continents and about 30 different cities, over 6,000 different providers in the last year and a half, 2 years, and that is always the statement. People's lives and medical conditions and health is as unique as their fingerprint and as unique as sitting in the exam room and having that personal relationship and interaction, that professional relationship with your provider. And the powerful thing beyond genetics and beyond all those things is really how your current situation sits in the timeline of your life, in the timeline of your environment. And we know that's important because we know that genes can be turned on and off, encouraged or discouraged, even within 6 hours after what they eat. It can be turned on and off within minutes of marked stress. And so even though we have the genome, we have this phenomenal code that makes up our individuality, our genome is very dynamic. Only about 10% of our 10% of our genome codes for proteins. And we look for those proteins and those cofactors that help us function in some of the gene testing that we have done. And what you've spent some time with in the last few weeks or last few months has been talking about a couple enzymes, results of protein transcription, a couple enzymes, methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase enzyme, or the enzymes involved in methylation or methionine metabolism or folate metabolism or neurotransmitter metabolism. And I think that it's just important to know that it's part of a whole symphony. And if we focus too much on one aspect of that symphony, too much on the piccolos or too much on the cellos or too much on the tubas or the percussion section, things can be a little bit out of balance. And so the big challenge for each of us is how do we figure out what we need as individuals? So part of that is reflecting, one, on your family history. Okay, so when you look at your family history, do you have a history of stroke, diabetes, heart disease, multiple miscarriages, schizophrenia, severe depression, gout, cleft palate, tongue tiedness? What is your family history? Because if you have a, if you contemplate your family history and write it down and see a pattern, the fact that you have it in your family history increases your relative risk of those conditions by 2 to 5 times. Where genes, genetic markers, may only increase your chance of a condition by 1.2 to 1.5 times. So it is the, and what that mismatch suggests is, it is really important what we wash over our genes, the environment of our family habits, the environment of our sleep habits, the environment of our eating habits, the environment of how we live. Our genes respond by turning on and off in different patterns. And so that's the first step. And a lot of people don't have really firm recollection, or they really haven't mined their family history very much. And you can actually mine your family history and then begin to record it. The believe it or not, the federal government put on a very available website ability to record your family history in the cloud, and you can go back to it and add it when you find out. And I think it's a very important website because it's one that you can, it's very easy, and you record it, and then you can download your PDF into your files, and that way you have it with you. So when you go to a clinician's office and they ask you for your family history, it's printed out and it's right there. That website is just familyhistory.hhs.gov, and that is just a very useful tool for us as individuals, and also as we begin to interface with more physicians. Because when you start looking through records, family histories are somewhat neglected. So we start with the family history. And with the family history, what your conditions that run in your family can give you a hint as to what genes you might want to check. Now, there has been an absolute revolution since 2006, and that is the direct-to-consumer genomics. So, as you know, companies like Decode or companies like 23andMe started going direct-to-consumer, and that is like translating the Bible in the Middle Ages. Suddenly, when the Bible was translated into a form that the Protestant Reformation, the people could read, suddenly they were discussing what it meant amongst themselves. And so that is exactly what's happening with genomics and direct-to-consumer genomics. gene testing. Because what happens is, and it's created a bit of a challenge to medicine and a bit of a challenge to the federal government, because direct-to-consumer genetic testing really begins to approach the your and my desire to know what is in our genes. And by being able to order it online and then having it come directly to you and then you getting the results. You know, it's interesting in studies that in Johns Hopkins and a couple and Cleveland Clinics, they showed that of the people who did their direct genetic testing, only about a little over 28% of people actually discussed it with their physician. So that is a very interesting trend, because when we get all this information, all this great information about our genetics, it is really how do we evaluate it? Isn't it true? You know, these direct-to-consumer companies, they can identify your relative risks of 793 different conditions. Everything from relative risk to different medication adverse reactions to even your relative risks of getting of having a heart attack. And so the challenge with these direct-to-consumer companies is how they reported the information. And that's what got them into hot water with the federal government and the FDA, because they were reporting your risk of getting and in saying you had good genes or bad genes, and really didn't help put it into really a form in which you realize that if you have this genetic uniqueness and you can wash over it a different diet, then you have a point of control in which, by your personal decisions, you can make a difference in your health. So what we do with that is very interesting, because I would say between 10 and 15% of our patients bring to us their reports, bring to us some report from their 23andMe genome evaluation, bring us their report from that $99 salivary sample evaluation of their genome. And they want to know what they can do to improve their health. They also want to know what we can do to allay fears or anxiety they may have because of the report. So what do you do with that as a provider, and what do you do with that as a owner of your genes? Well, what you do is you have a conversation. There's almost no other group in the whole subspecialties to deal with that than, one, your primary care provider who you have a long-term relationship, and then with a decision between you and the primary care provider if you need to go deeper with a geneticist or deeper with another provider. So to do that, you can, and I will just say, if somebody comes to us in our clinic and they want to have their genomics done, on the market currently, the least expensive way to get some idea of what your genome is, the portion of your genetic material that codes for proteins and these enzymes that play such a role in disease formation, we suggest they go and they have their 23andMe done, if we're looking generally, or if we really want to, if they have conditions like diabetes or heart disease or they've had a history of stroke, or we may have them use pathway genomics testing. So what you do with these is, once you get the results back, then you can...
I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
What's the difference between 23andMe and a pathways genomics?
Yeah. So 23andMe currently runs the genome, and they can, according to FDA regulations now, they can tell you about your heritage. But what we do with it as providers, and what you can do with it as a owner when you get it back, is you can go to a site snippedia.com, and you can follow the thread to Prometheus, Prometheus, and you can actually get for $5, you can get a printout of 7 different reports. One that shows your increased relative risk for certain, your genetic increased relative risk for certain conditions, your genetic increased relative risk for adverse drug reactions, your genetic relative risk for genes that do not promote health, your genetic a list of your genes that do promote health, and you can get that whole rundown. Now, 23andMe Pathway Genomics is a little more specific. It's not quite as general. They will go ahead and report and give you suggestions on diet interventions depending on your metabolic type. And so Pathway Genomics is ordered via the physician or clinician, where 23andMe, currently you can order it by yourself.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. So there are some challenges. There are some challenges with these direct-to-consumer genetic testing. One, there are about 20 papers a day published about new findings in SNPs. So that's thousands of papers. That's thousands of papers a year. How do you keep up? Secondly, your provider may not be comfortable with going over the information. Yet, your desire to know how it affects you is high. It is for me. I want to know what changes I can make in my diet, and I want to know if I have anxiety or if I have depression. Is there things that I can do to improve that? And there are clues with your genetics. So, those are some of the barriers, meaning science is rapidly moving. Your clinician may not feel comfortable with it, but you really want to know. So what you can do with that is you can actually, very simply, if you have questions about whether your detox pathways are slowed or whether you have trouble with this one carbon metabolism or methylation, then Ava, you can tell me whether they've already talked about genetic genie and generate reports off that. But you can go ahead and interface your 23andMe with genetic genie online, and it will give you a report. And these reports are very interesting. And let me tell you why they're interesting. Because each of these reports, they have on them each gene uniqueness has an assigned number. It's called an RS number or a registered SNP number, an RS number. And you can plug that number into websites like Snippedia, and it will give you direct access to the different information from the Library of Medicine on that genetic uniqueness. And so you can actually, with your provider or with yourself, you can begin to understand, well, am I part of this group, this ethnic group that has an increased risk? And what we find with this and being able to mine this information ourselves, we can find that you, instead of creating anxiety, you can create hope, and then it begins to help form a treatment plan. So there's a phenomenal amount of information at your fingertips. And then what do we do with that information? Part of that is getting comfortable with, we are recently discovering the world is not flat, which means just because you have the genes doesn't mean that you have to suffer the consequences of those genes. And that is a whole new area of understanding and uniqueness. We know that, for example, if you make a morning smoothie out of the same amount of protein, fat, and carbohydrate, but instead of the protein you used, meaning like whey or vegetable protein, you use animal protein instead of the fat. Instead of using polyunsaturated fats, omega-3, omega-6 acids, you use saturated fat. And instead of the carbohydrate being complex carbohydrate from vegetables in your smoothie, you're using more simple, low-fiber carbohydrate. We know that just mixing those smoothies up and you drink the green omega-6 rich vegetable protein, whey protein smoothie, you'll actually turn on the genes that are anti-inflammatory within 6 hours of you drinking that smoothie. So if you have trouble with inflammation, you know that just by your choices for breakfast, your choices for lunch, your choices for your big dinner, can actually, by adding the spices of curcumin and rosemary, you can actually epigenetically turn on and off in that environment around the gene, turn on and off those genes that promote inflammation or decrease inflammation. So a lot of this is really getting comfortable with unknown significance. If I have this genetic uniqueness, how significant is it? Is it going to make me more likely to have cancer? Do I genetically have predisposed to cancer or to heart disease? And I think what we've learned from that is we've learned over the last number of years that only less than 30% for sure of cancers, and depending on the population and the age, less than 10% of cancers are genetic.
You said something about when you add the spices, and I miss what happens. Which spices that you said? I think I heard rosemary, but the other question is, personally, I switched from store-bought meats and vegetables to only grass-fed beef and only chickens that peck bugs and only organic vegetables. Does that kind of meat make a difference?
It does. If you notice the taste of grass-fed versus corn-fed beef is different. Partly is because what is in the fat. You'll even notice the color of the fat is different. It's a little more yellow, a little more beta carotene. It has a little more. It has a lower fat content than the corn-fed and beef. It does actually have a lower in the grass-fed beef that's organic, does not eat pesticide sprayed grass, then the actual pesticide levels in the meat is different. How it is slaughtered makes a difference. For example, if in the this may seem like a odd word, but in humane slaughtering, where there's not a lot of stress for the animal, they're not in a line, then what happens is in the last 5 minutes before they are slaughtered, their adrenal glands do not secrete all this stress hormone. They've actually done studies now where when you look at the stress hormone content of the meat that you consume in the slaughterhouse beef compared to the non-slaughterhouse beef, the humanely sacrificed animals, that their stress hormone levels in the meat that you consume is lower. Now, that actually, those same stress hormones are in the meat that you consume.
So that fat affects, doesn't it have more folate in it as well?
It has more of the green. Yeah, it has more of the. So it has more of the beta carotene. Remember the muscle may have more folate because the water soluble B vitamins are more in the muscle than it is in the fat.
So we don't have. In other words, I want to understand it clearly, and if I'm right, I want my listeners to understand. They don't have to be paranoid about having meat if they eat clean meat, so to speak, right?
Right. The clean meat, there are less problems with clean meat. Absolutely.
Okay. Now that I've asked that question, I have another question.
Yeah.
So you've given us the scenario about the smoothie and the whey protein and the fatty acids.
Yeah, yeah.
And we have this clean meat alternative. Let's just not even worry about the bad meat anymore.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Is there a preference there?
The preference would be for you if you need complete protein, that you get complete protein. So if you have no... with the smoothie, it was a little more related to the fat issue, okay? So if you have... if your smoothie has saturated fat versus unsaturated fat, the unsaturated fat, you're going to turn on less inflammatory genes than in the saturated fat. So my thing is most of the clean organic meats are lower fat, leaner. Yes, you're going to have some saturated fat for sure in the meats, but you're going to actually, in the grass-fed, you'll have a different content, of polyunsaturated fats and your beta carotene, your vitamin A content. So the smoothie go ahead.
I was going to say, so I guess it's hard to, recommend to a patient which one, but what do you recommend? I mean, I don't know how to say that without being stupid, but what do you recommend to your patient? Is it so individual that you can't recommend, or if you had an optimum, what would that be?
My optimum would be a clean, complete protein, plenty of greens and color in the smoothie that will bring in all the polyphenols and all the communicating molecules that are in the colors of the rainbow that we consume. All your dark leafy greens are high. Most are high in magnesium. You think of your spinaches, and they have good sources of iron, and all the minerals that you get in your dark green vegetables are going to be rich cofactors that work with the other B vitamins in your metabolism. So I think it's better to eat whole food than it is to eat supplements, unless you need supplements as a bridge because you have an increased requirement.
Okay. And so you're saying do that smoothie, that's the prime thing than the meat, the grass-fed meat, right?
Right. Frequently, okay. people will, if they have, remember, 100 grams, 100 calories of carrots has more protein than 100 calories of steak.
Okay. That's wonderful. I get it now. Okay,
yeah.
Now, sorry, you can go on that. So I just wanted to understand that.
Sure. So my comment with a lot of this direct to genetic testing is it is here to stay. You know, over 800,000 people have ordered a 23andMe, and over 600,000 of those people have agreed to be in online research project. So we can understand more and more about what things turn on and off our genes, what genes are associated with different conditions. And it really is a fascinating period in medical and our personal history. It is so important that it turns out the federal government and the NIH has given a grant of over nearly $1.5 million to 23andMe to try to figure out how to interface the information from your genes that does not change with other platforms in medicine and health. Because they know the power that if we know that you have the genetics, so it is not good for you to take an aspirin, or it is not good for you to take Coumadin, the blood thinner, because you have increased risk of not being able to clot. Or if we know that you're at risk for these different medications, and you have that in your medical record, then there will be a flag that pops up if you go into the emergency room, eventually into the emergency room, to warn the provider that you're at risk, genetically at risk, if you have this exposed to this medication. And we know also that the correct administration of medicine in the hospital is the fourth leading cause of death in the United States.
So now I have a question that only probably you will know. How accommodating is insurance? And I don't want to go down this road because there's too much other important stuff, okay?
Yeah.
But how accommodating are insurance companies to patients today who want to go down this road?
So insurance companies, I think the accommodating from the standpoint of they can't discriminate against you for your genetic information anymore.
Will they pay for anything?
What they will pay for, it is disease-driven. So if you have a disease that has some associated genetics, they will go ahead and pay for it, right? But you can, with a $99 test, you can be armed with that information, okay?
So will they pay for any of the nutrition that you need to prevent some of these illnesses if you're presenting today?
So that's a good question. So the way that we find it in our clinic is that we, they have employees' health saving fund, right? And so that's their insurance. So most of those insurance health savings plans, if you as a patient takes the, and in communication with your provider, you come up with a list of the different supplements that you've decided are healthful for you, then if those are written out on a letterhead and written out to say these are necessary for the advancement of health and limiting the disease of the following diseases in this patient, then that most insurances take that as credit. So that can be used in the employee plan. And also we know that works for, we have patients that use that with the some of the interfaces for tax purposes also.
But no Obamacare or anything like that? That won't help you, right?
So, for example, no, we have not yet seen me writing a prescription for sublingual B12, over-the-counter vitamins that will be covered.
What about compounded vitamins?
Again,
and hormones.
Right. Not as easily.
Okay.
Yet.
So not as have you seen it at all, or it's just
yes,
a hard road?
We've seen it in a few. So it's been one of those things that I think in the States it's interesting. In the States that where naturopaths are allowed to be primary care physicians, those are the states also where the Board of Pharmacies and the insurances have been a little bit more accommodating. And more and more states are seeing the abject and absolute wisdom in having our naturopath colleagues being able to be primary care physicians and covered by insurance.
Okay. Well, what about if a medical doctor writes it?
As a medical doctor writes it, it usually it's getting less appeals, but sometimes it gets through without appeal anymore.
Well, that's certainly worth someone trying.
Yeah, it is. Okay. Yeah. It really is. And what's also interesting is now some of the compounding pharmacies will let you know whether Medicare covers XYZ amount and how you have to have it written.
Well, before we move on from this topic, I have to say one thing, and that, you know, so many people, I see so many things come across my email box about how the government or whoever it is wants to control supplements. And I used to be adamantly against that. But today, with the things that I do know, And the understanding about how nutrition literally turns these genes on and off, I see the value in, because they're so powerful, in somebody prescribing them knowing what they're doing.
There is that, I think. And so then what we have to do as a country and in the medical profession is we really need to up our game. And part of upping that game is a structural shift, right? If we know that the average number of hours of medical school nutrition education in the United States is 19 hours in the 4 years and in residency, that's not enough. That's enough to maybe learn the great deficiency diseases, you know, pellagra, beriberi, scurvy, rickets. But it's not enough to learn intermediary metabolism and one carbon methylation pathways and the power of arginine or glutamine to help allay sickle cell crises, or the power of methylfolate if you truly have MTHFR issues and it's just not methylfolate, but bringing in the relationship with the other B vitamins, the other methyl donors, in the uniqueness of your SNPs. And so it's just not one size fits all. It's as unique as your fingerprint. And so if we don't have greater understanding of that, and it is kind of like the wild, wild west, then people can go months, if not years, feeling worse without the correct targeted intervention that is important for them.
I had to learn that experience myself. And now that you brought up the methyl donors thing,
yeah,
I know so many people, they go to their doctors and they run this test. They, oh, I got a genetics test. And what they do is they run that B12, that folate test,
yeah,
and tell you if they think you have MTHFR. Or they run the MTHFR test, and that's
right.
It. So the people run home, take, excuse me, folate or folic acid, God forbid, and B12, and they start really feeling bad.
Right.
So I want to know, how do you know, let's just say when you start taking these things, you feel good 1 second, and the next second you start getting anxiety.
Right.
And then from there, you may start getting like mucus in your lungs or an asthma kind of thing. How do you know whether to do a methyl donor or a methyl sponge? And then when you figure out if you need a donor or a sponge, how do you figure out if that donor or sponge should be niacin or B12 or B2 or B6, you know, or how do you figure out which one for which kind of symptom?
Yeah, isn't that tough?
Yeah.
It really is tough, and that's where I go a little bit. So I think that the important thing to note is that in folic acid metabolism, you know how in the knee bone's connected to the ankle bone, connected to the foot bone, you know, connected to the hip bone? Imagine that could be considered in series, right? So the hip is in series with the knee, which is in series with the ankle, which is in series with your foot. They are one connected to the other. There are 52 different genetic enzymes or genetic proteins or genetic sites that are connected to folate.
Let me ask you another question to go with that so you can incorporate in your answer.
Yeah.
Let me see how to word this the right way. Oh, I lost it. I can't do it. I have to come back. It didn't go out of my head. Sorry.
Fair enough. So my comment is this. I think when part of the drivers for the take folate issue, the take methylfolate issue were two. One, the first reason that we added folic acid, the synthetic folic acid, to the diet was to try to really, as a country, was to try to really decrease the number of neural tube defects in our offspring, because not getting enough of folate in the first preconception, in the first 10 weeks of life, led to disastrous neurologic issues for the offspring. And the paralysis and the decreased function of the lower extremities was a very rare and, I mean, very real and tragic issue. And so that connection led to our nationwide adding of folic acid, a synthetic folic acid. The only reason it was synthetic is it had a longer shelf life. We knew for a long time that it wasn't the active form that our body needs. But the active form that our body needs passes very quickly. And the active form that our body needs that we get from vegetables and the family of folates that we get from vegetables, if somebody has this genetic uniqueness, they have to eat a lot of vegetables. And what happens to the American processed food, rapid-paced lifestyle is most Americans do not eat enough. And so they added the synthetic form. So that was the first one. Then with the increased depression, increased use of medications to try to help with depression, they saw the association that if they just bypassed the folic acid and offered the active folate, you have to go through 5 steps to get to the active folate, the methylfolate. If they bypassed that and just gave them methylfolate, they found that a lot of people with depression, in the fluid that bathes their brain, really had low levels of methylfolate. And so if they just gave methylfolate, that they would have to be, their depression would get better, and they would have to take less medication. So I can see how the dots are connected. But then became the issue, right? The issue was that if you just give methylfolate and forget about the 52 other enzymes, or whether you forget about niacin or SAMe or choline from eggs or DHA from essential fats or B12 from yeast and meats or magnesium, the other cofactors, if you just give folate in itself, it really tilts the balance and drives the metabolism one way and excludes others. And then, so we also know that things in our lifestyles increase our requirement for folate, B12, B6, thiamine, and niacin. And those include alcohol consumption. It includes being male. It includes alcohol, smoking. It includes eating low doses, low amounts of these vitamins that I mentioned. And also our absorption of these vitamins gets slower with age. So your question was, how do we go about the business of figuring it out? Well, it used to be that we only followed homocysteine. Well, homocysteine is a blood marker that you've talked about, but there are a lot of things that affect homocysteine, at least multiple different enzymes that are involved in B12, B6, sulfur metabolism, folate metabolism. So if you just look at homocysteine and your homocysteine isn't elevated, it does not mean that you don't have issues with methylation. So I think the best way to do it is in a combination of a couple things. One, you look at your family history. Do you have a family history with birth defects or cleft palate or neural tube defects, or do you have a lot of heart disease or stroke disease or clotting of the blood vessels to the leg disease or schizophrenia or those kind of issues? If you have a lot of those, then you have to consider getting some blood work. Okay, so if you have blood work and you get things like homocysteine, and you can do the more specialized tests where you look for this marker called MMA or methylmalonic acid, that lets you know about B12. If you get a marker called FIGLU or formaminoglutamic acid, that lets you know about your folate. And you can look at these things and then get an idea about whether you have issues with enough B6 and your sulfur metabolism, or whether you have issues with B12 or you have issues with your folate. You can also check, you can also see if you break down the folate in your blood by checking methylfolate or unmetabolized folate in your bloodstream. So
are these things that people can get covered by their insurance or not?
Yes, good question. So
and
you
will Obamacare cover this for people?
Yes, so they will cover things like homocysteine. They will cover things like methylmalonic acid. And if you can show, if your doctor does a vibration sense test, just a tuning fork on your toes and your fingers, and you have decreased vibration sense, then they'll also cover that fig glue. They will cover. If you know that you have issues with folate, they will cover some of the different folates, but they have to be coded correctly by your clinician. So here's the other thing you can do. Well, the other thing you can do is do that $99 23andMe test. And you can see if you have some of the genetics that would tie to your lab work. And if you do, then you can figure out if you need increased folate or increased B12 or these other things. So you become a little bit your own Sherlock Holmes, tell you the truth.
Yeah, you have to actually step up to the plate and take responsibility for your health.
Yeah.
So we've got 10 minutes. I just want to let you know so you can pick out the things you think we need to talk about. Let me see if there's any. I think I had a couple questions I wanted to ask you. We talked about methyl donors. Oh, the next one. One of the things that are recommended for people, particularly with MTHFR, is amino acids.
Yeah.
Well, first thing they do is run out and get arginine.
Yeah.
And you know what happens to people who have viral lesions or viral things going on. What do those people do, or that have that nitrous oxide gene? What do those people do? Do you take arginine? Do you not? How do you get the benefits from those things if you can't take? If you have those bad genes that won't let you.
Sure. So one thing you can do is increase the nitric oxide levels in your diet, and that's one of the great ones is beets.
So it doesn't. That kind of thing won't cause those viruses to express if you get it naturally. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, not nearly as much.
Wonderful.
Yeah. So we're in the winter. So what a great time to try borscht. Increase beet soups, right? And increase beets, and you can also check through Berkeley Labs. You can get these. These strips online, you can actually check your nitric oxide levels in your saliva.
That's great. Okay, let's see, there was another question I wanted to... I have so many, they fly up, I can't blurt them out, you know. Oh, well, just keep going, because I can't remember what... It flew away.
So I think a couple things. I think that... I encourage the way we approach the MTHFR SNPs and the CBS SNPs in our clinic, the methylation SNPs, is we try to develop a good base of the broad range of B vitamins in the diet or in the supplement bridge. And so the supplements, if we use a supplement, we will use, it will have niacin, moderate niacin, 50 milligrams with a little more. It will have the activated B12. It'll have the activated thiamine, the activated B6. It will have in their diet or supplement bridge, you will have the cofactors. You'll have the magnesium. You'll make sure you have zinc. You'll make sure you have the fat-soluble vitamins, vitamin D. So it is not a single, you make sure you have a good base, a good foundation to help bring balance when you add a little bit more of the B6 or the B12 or the folate, the methylfolate.
So here's a question that you brought to focus for me. Let's just say that you've had someone that's been doing this for a few years and who's been found out that they had a snippet regardless of what the snippet is.
Right.
And they started heavily targeting it nutritionally. through right. their, say through a physician or
right.
nutritioner. How long, you know, typically I think some of them are 3 to 5 years that it takes to restore your levels. And that's an assumption, an opinion that I'm making based on interviews. It's not something I know. So when you heavy dose, how long do you heavy dose before you, or can you ever go back to normal,
sure.
Sustainable doses? And how long is that? And how do you know about that? And we've got about 5 minutes, 6 minutes.
Sure. So what we usually do is we will try, first of all, we use some type of symptom listing. So we use a medical symptom questionnaire in our clinic. So if we start somebody on a supplement program, and these are medical symptoms that deal with everything from anxiety, depression, to fluttering heart, to, you know, your review system. So we will get that score when we start. And we will check at 1 week, either by phone, or we have the patient check in with our nutritionist just 2 weeks, and at 4 weeks, and then we start spreading that out. And we want to see if their symptoms are improving or worsening with their supplementation. And then if they are worsening, we sit down and try to figure out what are the symptoms that are worsening and if we need to change the balance of the nutritionals. Okay. And then we will, if they reach a plateau at even 3 months where they're feeling pretty good, we will begin to back off a little bit and see if we can back down. Some people that have, there are some people that are only on the really high doses for weeks to a couple months before they're able to start coming back down. So, yes, it is individual, but I think it is also a challenge if we tell somebody that you're going to have to be on this for a 3 to 5 year plan without really checking in at the biomarkers and seeing them. We will look for biomarker change anywhere from 6 weeks to 3 months.
And do you do that through consultation, or do you do that through some kind of nutritional testing?
Yes. So we will do some nutritional testing, look at the biomarkers, but we also can, depending on their situation, we may just do it through consultation. So my comment is this. It has to be a really clear dialogue between you and who's ever helping you with this. You need to let them know whether you're feeling worse on these supplements or better, whether things are improved or worsened, and really note for you that realize that all the things that play a role in turning genes on and off, quality of sleep, number of times you wake up at night, how you do your food, do you do it 3 times a day, 2 times a day, 1 time a day, 5 times a day? What is that content of your food? What is the stress that you're up against? People that, firefighters, policemen, soldiers have a much higher B vitamin requirement than people who don't have a lot of stress, a lot of physical stuff. People in phenomenally stressful situations, single parents who have food insecurity, have children, have a much higher requirement for, because of the stress hormones that are involved, than people that are just chill, and then have an easier life, and then that whole life washes over your genes. So my thing is, in summary, there's a powerful tool out there, and that's called direct-to-consumer genomics that you can get. And that can help you guide some of your personal decisions. And especially in the setting of knowing your family history, knowing when your timeline of your life and your condition, and you can actually shift disease toward health and limit the genetics of your potential illness by addressing them with your daily decisions and opportunities to change your what genes are turned on and turned off in an epigenetic fashion. And it is a phenomenally hopeful situation versus anxiety and this is my lot and this is what I'm doomed to become.
You have been phenomenal. Thank you. I can't thank you enough for taking time to do this tonight. And I know we talked about this before the show, but I'm going to put you on the spot. I hope you will promise to come back in the next few months' time, and talk some more, please.
It would be my pleasure.
So anyway, thank you. I'm so grateful. Please, would you say one more time where people can find you? Do you do any phone consults, anybody in your clinic?
We do some phone consults and Skype consults. Yes, we do. We're at ashlandmd.com.
Thank you so much, Dr. Stone.
You bet.
I'm going to be in touch about having you back soon.
All right.
Have a good
care.
One.
Good night. Blessings. Bye-bye.